Welcome, everyone. I am very pleased today to, on the behalf of the California Breast Cancer Research Program, welcome you all to a panel to discuss the cancer disparities that are occurring not only here in the state of California, which is the focus of our particular program, but also that occur in other states, and not just in breast cancer, but actually in all cancers that we have seen. So the first thing I want to mention is the use of the word disparities, and somebody brought it up again just before we started today, while we were just getting ready. And I want to let you know that the use of the word disparities is actually my fault, not any of the panelists, and explain why I use the term disparities and why we actually are still using it within our program. For us, the idea of, especially in breast cancer, of understanding what those differences are and what understanding why there's a disparate incidence or mortality, a difference in those things, is important. And the disparity then in incidence in between white non-Hispanic women of higher income, they actually have a higher incidence, where of estrogen receptor positive breast cancer, whereas African American women in the United States have a much earlier onset of breast cancer. They tend to be lower income, and they tend to get triple negative breast cancer, which is much more invasive and much more deadly. So they have a much higher mortality. So the term inequity implies to many of the projects that we actually fund at the California Breast Cancer Research Program, or CBCRP, but we use the word disparities here advisedly. So don't blame the folks on the panel. I do want to thank all the panelists for actually making it here, two of them from the East Coast, one from the Midwest. One of the things that we have been talking about at our CBCRP is the idea, oops, we went two in, did not mean to do that. So here is a very small and easy diagram for you to be able to follow along with. Yes, what I want to point out here is the complexity of breast cancer, like many other cancers, and like health in general. We had funded a group of Bob Hyatt's at University of California at San Francisco, and this diagram is actually not something you have to try to figure out and make a copy of yourself. It's actually in the IOM Breast Cancer and the Environment report that came out last year. So I would, if you are interested in all the little bits and pieces that go along with this, please go ahead and see that document. But I want to point your attention to, in the four corners, that they had chosen with an expert panel four kind of areas or sectors that influence breast cancer risk. So this is postmenopausal incidence risk. So many of the things in here we're pretty comfortable and used to seeing when looking at cancer risks, especially breast cancer risk. So things like over here on the far right in yellow, the high penetrance genes, the age at menopause, endogenous hormone levels, age at menarche. Those things are the biological constructs that underlie incidence. And those are things that we kind of take as things we cannot change. The things we focused on in breast cancer research are usually the ones down here in the left-hand corner, and those are the behavioral things like tobacco use, alcohol use, physical activity, and obesity. And much of the work that has been done in breast cancer has looked at that. One of the things in our program that we feel has not been given sufficient attention are the areas in the top right, the chemical and physical environments, and here in the top left, the societal and cultural. So we have asked the folks here today to come and take a look at those. And I actually meant to go through this part while I told you about the biological. So we're going to be starting out today with Dr. Vince Cogliano, who is from, oh, one more thing I did want to add. And then there's, of course, it's not just that there are those four sectors. There's also, over the course of the lifespan, there are different kinds of impacts, influences on a person's life. And so those also need to be taken into account. They're oftentimes called the windows of susceptibility or vulnerability. And the speakers today are going to be addressing some of those really critical time periods when there might be more sensitivity to some of these exposures. So today we're going to start out with a presentation by Dr. Vincent Cogliano, and I'm going to keep it very short and just say that Dr. Cogliano is currently at the U.S. EPA, and he is running the, my slides went out here. Oh, it's right here, Integrated Risk Information System, like IRIS, IRIS, all the acronyms. Vince actually came to U.S. EPA after working for many years as the head of the International Agency for Research on Cancers at the World Health Organization in Lyon, France, which I am very envious that he got to live there. And he is going to talk to us today about the chemical side of things. So, Vince.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Catherine. Thank you also to the Breast Cancer Research Program in California for organizing this session and for inviting me here. You really have quite a resource with a state research program of the size of the California Breast Cancer Research Program. And I'm sure you wish you had more money to give out and more grants. It's really quite unusual that any kind of state can run a program like this. And so I just want you to know, when I come out to California, the rest of the country, there's a lot of people who are very envious of the types of programs you've been able to put into place over the last several decades. I should say, I was not the head of the International Agency for Research on Cancer. It was their monograph program, one of their programs. But I did enjoy living in France, and it's wonderful. I also enjoyed seeing the complex diagram for breast cancer that Catherine put up there. There are quite a few factors in there that I was pleased to see, and there were risk factors we identified in the monograph program just in the last few years. You might not have noticed sleep disturbance being in there, but there's a lot of studies of nurses, flight attendants, switchboard operators, and their risk of breast cancer can be 50% higher than comparable women in the same job who don't work at night. So there are a lot of risk factors we're just beginning to understand, and they're going to point to lots of mechanisms and hopefully ways to understand and control the disease. So I'm going to talk about carcinogens in general and the global burden of cancer, and that points to some of the disparities that we see. Then I'm also going to talk about how we identify known carcinogens and how we identify disparities among carcinogens. So in the year 2000, from IARC's World Cancer Report, there were 10 million cases of cancer diagnosed worldwide each year, 6 million deaths, and 22 million cancer patients worldwide. And the figures are expected to increase by 50% by the year 2020. And actually, these figures are increasing faster in the developing world than in developed countries. And so there are disparities, and the fastest growth is really in the developing countries, and those are the countries that have the least capacity to deal with a large cancer patient population. This is from IARC's figures about the top 10 cancers worldwide and then also in the United States. And they're mostly the same. You see some differences. For example, prostate cancer is only fifth worldwide, but it's second in the U.S. It's not to underestimate breast cancer in the U.S., but prostate cancer is a disease generally that shows up in older age populations, and the U.S. is a population with a longer life expectancy than the world at large. Some cancers, like liver cancer, are very high in some developed continents with a lot of developing countries, and they don't make the top 10 in the U.S. This figure is for liver cancer worldwide, and while you don't need to necessarily look at all of these numbers, they go from on the bottom. These are different regions of the country, reading from the top: East Asia, Southeast Asia, Middle Africa, Western Africa, Southern Africa, Melanesia, Central America. And with these numbers on the bottom, it's like a number of two or three on the bottom, and goes up to 20 to 30 in the regions of the world with the highest liver cancer rate. This shows that there really are some huge disparities, and they can come from lots of reasons. Sometimes it could be genetic makeup of different populations, but more likely it's the amount of exposures to different risk factors that people in different parts of the world are, their access to medical care. Sometimes you see differences in the disparity between incidence and mortality. So, for example, even the North American bar here, there is a mortality is much lower than the incidence, but that's not the case in some parts of the world. Carcinogens come in many forms, industrial chemicals and occupational exposure, medical, pharmaceuticals, biological agents, especially like human papillomavirus and hepatitis viruses and Helicobacter that are very prevalent in some parts of the world, physical agents and radiation, and personal habits like tobacco and alcohol. But it's not all tobacco and alcohol. No studies that try to attribute risks of cancer to various factors attribute more than about 30% to factors like tobacco and alcohol, which means there are a lot of other causes of cancer which are not necessarily under individuals' control that we have that are causing a lot of cancer. IARC has identified 107 known carcinogens, and some facts about those is research continues to identify them. Some carcinogens like asbestos and benzene and vinyl chloride were identified many decades ago, but 36 of the 107 were first identified by IARC after the year 2000. So new research is identifying more carcinogens. They're also identifying new cancer sites for already known carcinogens. For example, alcohol consumption was well known to cause liver cancer and oral cavity cancer, but it was recently, in the last couple of years, identified by IARC and looking at all the studies systematically, to be a cause of breast cancer and also colorectal cancer, which are two of the leading cancers anywhere in the world, and that shows that the global burden of cancer due to alcohol is higher than we'd previously thought. Also, further research continues to confirm carcinogenic potential under lower conditions of exposure. And about a year ago, I wrote with my colleagues from IARC, we summarized all the known carcinogens, and we identified four case studies where asbestos in the 1970s, the second volume of IARC monographs, said asbestos was a carcinogen in occupational conditions, but it had an explicit statement that it was not known to cause cancer in any consumer product or other kinds of occupational exposure. Recent years, there are clearly cancers that are arising from environmental exposure to people who are not working with asbestos. Similarly, in California, Prop 65 lists alcohol as a carcinogen under conditions of alcohol abuse. But more recent research out of the UK, the Million Women Study, shows that as little as 10 grams of alcohol a day has a significant risk of breast cancer. So it's not conditions of alcohol abuse, it's conditions of pretty much everyday exposure for some parts of the world. Other cases like that are tobacco smoke has been long known to cause lung cancer and many other cancers in smokers, but it wasn't until the last 10 or 20 years that it's really been recognized as environmental tobacco smoke also is a known cause of lung cancer. So there are many cases where residential or environmental exposures to known occupational carcinogens have been also confirmed. So I think we should be really very wary of people who tell you that these are only high-dose phenomena. If you study larger populations for longer periods of time, we have often seen cancers at lower doses. Now, the use of mechanistic data is to identify carcinogens is increasing. I'll talk about that in the future. This might be the tip of the iceberg. IARC has 107 known carcinogens, but 334 probable or possible carcinogens. And other agencies that identify carcinogens, like NTP and IRIS, the EPA, also have a large disparity between a smaller number of known carcinogens and a large number of possible carcinogens. And in the breast cancer realm, IARC has identified five known risk factors for breast cancer, but Ruth Ann Rudell of Silent Spring Institute compiled animal research on mammary tumors and found over 200 known or suspected carcinogens in animals that cause mammary gland tumors. And these often can't be studied in humans because most of what we know about in humans come from epidemiological studies, and most of these studies don't have enough women in the cohort to be able to get good figures to be able to do that. To be able to identify that it's a carcinogen in women, so breast cancer, ovarian cancer, cervical cancer really can't be studied in industrial cohorts.
cancer.
Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about disease prevention. In this society, everybody knows about primary, secondary, and tertiary prevention. The goal is primary prevention before disease begins. You get rid of the exposures. Secondary prevention is before disease is apparent, but after something has already started to happen. For example, periodic pap smears to detect precursors of cervical cancer. And tertiary prevention is your traditional cancer treatments after cancer has already been detected. So IARC says on their website, the first step in cancer prevention is to identify causes of cancer, and then you can take action to prevent avoidable exposures to known, probable, and possible carcinogens. And so that's what we'd like to do. So how have known carcinogens been identified? Generally, it's when you have sufficient evidence in humans. That is, you have an epidemiological studies that have identified a causal relationship, and you have sufficient confidence in those studies to rule out chance, bias, or confounding exposures as a cause of those increases in cancer. So about 80 to 90 carcinogens have been identified with that level of epidemiological evidence. About a dozen, and these are mostly components of complex mixtures, have been based on strong mechanistic evidence in exposed humans. This is like benzoapyrene, some other chemicals that only occur in mixtures and you can't study them by themselves. But understanding the mechanisms by which exposure leads to cancer has given us enough confidence to label them as carcinogen. And one, acetaldehyde associated with alcoholic beverages was identified based on a genetic epidemiology study that showed a polymorphism of enzymes that some people metabolize alcohol much more slowly than others, and they have a tenfold to up to a hundredfold higher risk of some types of cancers from alcohol. This identifies actually a genetic group, so that would point to disparity that comes from genetic factors. So what is mechanistic evidence? Mechanistic evidence is really trying to describe adverse outcome pathways that lead to cancer. So we have exposure on the left, and you could look at the dose to target cells, and then how the target cells respond to that dose, and then various events happen in those cells, and eventually you see a tumor. Epidemiological studies in the past generally really focused on exposure and cancer, or exposure and a disease, without trying to understand the process, the steps involved in between. And sometimes they do see a clear relationship between exposure and disease, and that's how we know about a lot of the carcinogens. But if we break this down, it gives us a lot of other questions we can ask. So for example, disparities in cancer incidence can result from population differences in any of these steps. There can be differences in exposure. People might live in an area where they're closer to factories that are emitting toxic chemicals, and they're more highly exposed. They may have greater tendency to have jobs that are exposing them to carcinogens. They might have less access to health care, so they won't be able to treat a cancer or have it detected as early. So there's a lot of just exposures that make differences. Doses to target cells, for example, polymorphisms and metabolism, where one group might metabolize a substance faster or slower than another group. Even with the same exposure, there could be differences there. Children have immature metabolic systems, immature immune systems, and so they could have a different response to the same dose that an adult would be able to handle, for example. And then various other events in the cells can also be affected by genetic or epigenetic factors that cut across the population, but in different ways. And finally, so that you can get differences in cancer incidence. And then cancer mortality versus cancer incidence. If you have better access to health care, better treatments, you could perhaps reduce your risk of mortality even after you develop the cancer. So by understanding different mechanisms, we can identify different types of disparities among different populations. So I think I had, maybe, is it the next slide? Yes. Mechanistic studies really answer both what causes cancer and how does it cause cancer. And if we only know what causes cancer, we can only look at differences in exposure in our attempts to identify ways to reduce disparities. But if we understand how something causes cancer, we can look at some other factors genetic, epigenetic factors that might explain differences between groups. Also interactions with other factors. For example, good nutrition, you'll have more, maybe less absorption of toxic chemicals and so on. So I want to have a few more slides. There's increasing evidence that the carcinogenesis can arise from early life exposure. So this is another type of disparity. DES has been known for decades, but more recently, tobacco smoking is associated with hepatoblastoma in smokers' children, and X-rays and gamma radiation has been associated with cancer in children. There's also limited evidence where it's not causal. It's not a we haven't ruled out all of the biases in some of the studies or confounding factors, but there's a large range of other exposures that early life exposure does seem to have a higher risk. So in summary, cancer is a major cause of death, and it's still increasing. There are hundreds of suspected carcinogens in the environment where further research is important. We have over 100 known carcinogens, but several hundred possible and probable carcinogens and many other chemicals that haven't even been tested, where further research would be important to identify these. And disparities can come from almost any place in the adverse outcome pathway, from the beginning at exposure to epigenetic and genetic factors in the development of cancer, and even in the end in treatment, societal factors can. So that's the slides I had. So I want to thank you very much.
Thank you. Oh, wait.